And this is a new show. It's called Touchstones. And this is my first show. The Touchstones is about religious experience. And religion is pretty much what anybody says they think it is. So we're going to have a wide definition of what religion is. We're going to reach a spectrum of experience to see how much and what people want. My first guest today is Demetrius Simeon, who is a student at UNC, a doctoral student at UNC Chapel Hill, doing his doctoral work in the sociology of religion. Demetrius, welcome.
Thank you.
So one of the things that I'm curious about, and what a constant possible a theme for this show is going to be, what is the nature of your own religious experience? So given that you are a reverend, what was your calling? How did you end up following the religious path and not the path of an academic or a scholar or other things that you might have decided to do?
Actually, I would probably say that above all things, I'm a community activist, and that I'm in the process of being ordained with the UCC Church, and that I'm a scholar. So I'm all three, actually, and I think it's important to for me to engage in all three areas.
Embrace all the identities.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, tell us about how did you find the United Church of Christ?
Huh. Well, I guess I'd have to step back a little bit and say that I was a sociology major, religion minor in Texas at a school called Trinity. And
yeah.
And that what happened is I actually dropped out of school twice. And along the way, I ended up getting sober. So I'm clean and sober for the past 14 years. And my embrace into any spiritual faith came through a 12-step program. And so once I got sober and came back to school, I was encouraged to go to Divinity School at Yale University. And I went as a non-Christian. So I went as just a person of faith to study what these Christians said they believed and how they did or did not match it with social behaviors, since I'm also a sociologist. And I specifically have an engagement with liberation theology, oppressed groups, Jews and blacks, and how they rely upon religion and God to overcome obstacles. Along the way, I basically embraced that into my own community activism, and I've been trained to do race dialogues and to work with community partners, and so a lot of that all kind of happened at once over a span of 14 years.
Well, that's a good long journey as far as it goes. So it seems that then your own religious faith was based on the difficulties you had with addiction and with the substance abuse of some sort.
Yeah, my own identity issues and needing to figure out who I am and in what setting, and also to figure out the UCC came into play because a lot of my friends at Yale University were UCC, and they were very embracing of me even though I wasn't a Christian. And so that kind of made an impression upon me.
Yeah, I've always been very fond of the United Church. I've always been very fond of the United Church of Christ, in that they are a open and a community aware. They want to practice a social justice form of their religion, and I find that very refreshing. Though my own personal religion tends towards the contemplative, almost to the exclusion of social activism, I have, as it were, a strong conscience around social justice issues. I was active in this community for a while in anti-racism issues.
Cool.
However, I don't have a sense of a personal support network that that for me sustains, you know, long-term involvement in anti-racist issues. I don't want to necessarily get up there and constantly do it. And being white, it's a different situation. Racism comes part of my thing about being whether I'm part of the
establishment.
I am a part of the establishment. I realize that my life being white has a natural privilege in it in this society that allows me to live more comfortably than if I had been a person of color. Mm-hmm. And I can see that, and because of my own experiences as a child, which was sort of as an outcast, I have a natural affinity for outcasts.
Yeah, me too. I was an outcast as well. So
yeah.
It didn't depend. It because I'm my eyesight is so poor and has been. It's like myopic vision physically led to a spiritual or a community kind of connected vision that I basically cultivate, because no matter what setting, black, white, I'm an African American male, by the way, mm-hmm. to those listening. Basically, in whatever setting, rich or poor, I was always put down upon because of the thickness of my glasses. And so I really felt like an outcast everywhere.
Yeah.
Which fed into my addiction later.
Yeah, well, I also had a bout with addiction. I was a child of the '60s, and I grew up in San Francisco in the middle '60s. So I was actually living in Haight-Ashbury before anybody else knew about the place.
Yeah, I was trained as a chaplain in Haight-Ashbury, and I'm also from Oakland, California, as you know, and a child of the Black Panthers Feed the Children program and Head
right.
Start programs.
Yeah, so you know. Yeah, so that's probably about a decade or so of difference in our ages mm-hmm. as far as the one of the experiences I had is this being a personal outcast, not quite fitting into school, not quite fitting into sports. Part of it had to do with childhood and the way I was raised in my particular family. But all of it led to an instinctive thing that, you know, people are important, and people are more important than the stuff that people use to make themselves feel important, you know?
Definitely.
And, you know, though this is Touchstones is going to be a show about religion, and religion is pretty much the way any of us wish to define it. That's hardly going to fit well with people who are institutionally trained in their religions, but you know, many of us have not been raised in religions. At least probably 20-30% of our population now is not raised in religion. And the people who are raised in religion are given an inadequate religious education. In other words, they still foster images of the divine, which make sense if you're 5 or 6 years old and the divine parent is a comforting image because you still trust mommy and daddy. But by the time you become an adult, you recognize that mommy and daddy, though, as good as they were for you, weren't good enough, weren't just good enough. And this needing a better than a good enough daddy, you think, well, you know, maybe God isn't quite a good enough parent either.
I wish most more people questioned like that. I think actually most people fall into the safety net of, you know, if I don't question, things will be okay. And then, unfortunately, other things start happening in our society, and then there's a disconnect almost where, hey, as long as I'm safe within my confines of my church or temple or whatever, then I'll be fine, and I don't necessarily need to worry about what's going on that's not in my backyard kind of thinking.
I've been involved in church work on and off for about 20 years, mostly Unitarian Universalism. However, I haven't been active in a church for the last 10 years, and I'm quite happy not being a member of the church, probably for the very reasons that you just stated there. I'd state them a little differently. I think people actually belong to churches, and this is obviously something that deserves challenge, belong to churches in order to have non-threatening relationships. In other words, it's sort of like I can have the appearance of friends. I can have the appearance of belonging, and no one really needs to know who I am. I can fit in here if I pretend.
See, and now you're getting into my realm. As a sociologist, I'm looking at identity in social networks and how people, I mean, I went with a chip on my shoulder to Divinity School of, yeah, right, y'all believe this stuff, but I don't see it happening. Being a poor person from Oakland, black male, who was not churched, we moved around a lot between Texas and California, and my mother would encourage me to go to church to get an idea of God or to have a social support group. But I never was, like, in a particular tradition. And so I kind of grew up kind of like with a neo-Marxist, Berkeley, Oakland activist stance that I think still fuels most of what I do anyway. I just have found a church that embraces me and embraces the fact that I'm contemplative with my Buddhist training and also in with my agnostic, scientific, humanistic ideas. I've found a church that actually is open enough to receive me, and I receive it because it actually practically involves itself with work in the community and change.
Yeah, and that's one of the beautiful things about the United Church of Christ. It will even accept you if you aren't accepting of Christ.
Well, we, you know, they hope that we head that
eventually,
direction.
Eventually. Well, actually, I am a true believer in what I call the universal Christ, which is the Christ for the anyone and everyone.
Yes.
Now, if Christ was the important person that he was to be, and it was in a cosmological sense of it, really meant the change from a certain type of human being to another possible human possibility. And basically, the human possibility that Christ portends is that we can all know God directly.
Exactly. And that's actually what UCC definitely stands behind, that in the fact that dialogue and any tensions are welcome at our table so we can discuss them. And that's what's embracing about UCC.
And that understanding is actually an act of forgiveness and prayer.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
The one of the things that as I said, is that I would like to see churches be embracing of more genuine experience, and I do feel that members who have stayed in churches for long times have experiences of true friendship and belonging. However, it always exists within a certain context. And sometimes when those contexts change, like in my particular case, when my wife left me, you know, the church sort of decided that the wife was easier to get along with than I was. And I was sort of, you know, in a very subtle way, sort of, exiled, you know. And I said, well, this just shows you there's a level of superficiality in this level, and single people need a different type of relationship, which churches generally in our society are not well equipped to support.
Absolutely.
They can be, and I know that a number of them have tried to, and some of them with some success. What I'd like us to do is we're here actually also to talk about some community initiatives that deal with incarceration and with the amnesty program that's been going on. And I know you've got some good information about that. What I'd like to do is take a moment to for a slight musical interlude, and then we will come back and begin to discuss some of these initiatives that you've got going.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we're at WCOM, and this is a new show. We're WCOM Carrboro in Chapel Hill, Community Radio Co-op. And we are at, what are we?
103.5.
Oh, we're at 103.5. I was looking, I need to remember where the signs are here. And we're going to, I wanted to say what that music was. That was Rhonda Cadell from a recording called The River Runs, and that was Autumn Leaves. Demetrius, let's talk some social justice issues. And we did a little navel gazing in our first part, which is what I'm happy about. But let's deal with some of the initiatives that are happening in our community in the next within the next few weeks.
Okay, that's my favorite thing to do. I think it might be good if I just mention one at a time, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
First thing that I'd like to say is that there's a program called Community Success Initiative that's working with a gentleman named Dennis Gaddy, who's an ex-offender out of Raleigh. And he's going around, he's got a Department of Corrections support, and he's going around the state basically helping different people set up roundtables so that they can bring community partners together to talk about what issues are going on with ex-offenders. And there's a job fair being held October 30th, and it's at, there's a light lunch that'll be served, and we need employers who are interested and willing to come and get information about how to employ these men coming back into our community. We also deal with women, but that's also part of it. It's a free event. It's free to set up a booth. We also need ex-offenders who are out there who need jobs. A light lunch will be served. It's going to be October 30th, Tuesday, from 10:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at the Hargraves Community Center, 216 North Robertson Street, Chapel Hill.
And let's talk a little bit about employers and dealing with ex-offenders. The thing is I have the media stereotype.
Yes, tough.
The media stereotype is that the ex-offender gets out of prison and is immediately bullied by people. He's forced to. We seem to have a call here. Let's see, folks. You got to remember that this is my first show, and I'm still learning how to do all the bells and whistles.
Say hello. You're on the air.
Hello. You're on the air. This is WCOM Touchstones. You're on the air.
Oh, I don't need to be on the air.
Okay, we'll take you off the air then.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. So.
The media stereotype employees.
Yeah. You know, and immediately they're forced to give their work for minimum wage, and you know have to give a kickback to their employer, and you know there's a whole variety of the stereotype.
If they're able to get a job at all.
If they're able to get a job at all.
Yeah.
And let's discuss how a lot of these guys, when they get out, are really hopeful that they can do a turnaround, at least initially.
Yeah, well, 80% of the people who are in prison right now, are in jails or whatever, are there because of substance abuse issues. Unfortunately, as you know, in the 80s and 90s, a lot of public services were cut, the ones that we had available. And so now, instead of helping to address these people's issues before they get arrested, we now have laws that arrest them for these issues. And so a lot of these people are there for nonviolent crimes. A lot of them have been in even for the violent crimes. And they're about restitution. They're about change. They've done a lot of work inside. And they just need an opportunity, a second chance, if you will.
Yeah. And the other thing is that also people who sometimes who do use substances abusively are masking other issues.
Absolutely.
Issues of abuse, poverty. there's a whole variety of other issues that this use of substances is covering over. All of which means that we aren't addressing human suffering in a positive and proactive way as a community.
Yes.
And So let's say I'm an employer.
Okay.
Okay, I'm an employer, and I have to go by my experience. I am a tiny employer. I mean, I've got 3 employees. Why would I possibly want to take the time to train somebody who's an ex-offender?
A couple of things I'd like to say is, A, I've been successful at placing someone with a local person who was willing to employ an ex-offender, and it's gone well. He's become, over time, he became the manager. Now he's actually transitioning into another field after a year of working with him. And that was before he was out of prison, and now he got released and he's in. So, A, we've got success stories.
That's good.
B, we have people who have screened them while they've been in prison, and these are the people who have been actively trying to seek better ways, working hard, already on work release programs, and they've got an established record of working well. And then C, you know, we take our time, because our reputations are on the line, those of us who are involved in this work, to make sure that these are the right people, and we do follow-up work with them. And so it's not just them that you would be getting. You'd be getting a whole set of people around them that can help them and you through whatever issues you might have if you choose to employ them.
Yeah. So in other words, it's not just just an individual taking a chance on another individual. Mm-hmm. You're actually working in a program, and you're working to, you know, help someone make our community more humane for more of us.
For all of us, because yes. The thing that happens, the consequence of coming out and not being able to have jobs or other services, is that these guys often feel like they have no other choice but to do what basically got them arrested in the first place. And that's a public safety and crime issue that can be avoided if more of us step up and offer and help commit to these people and to our community.
So repeat again where and when this opportunity is. And we're sure that we've got a couple of potential employers out there that should obviously go by and find out more.
Well, if you want information, you can call Dennis Gaddy, the Executive Director of Community Success Initiative, at 614-2369. The event is on October 30th. It's at the Hargraves Community Center, 216 North Robertson Street, Chapel Hill, downtown.
And let's have that phone number again.
Yes, the phone number, Dennis Gaddy, is 614-2369.
And tell them that you heard about it from Touchstones, that cool. WCOM.
And there's a free lunch available.
And it's one of the few times where you'll actually get a free lunch.
No doubt. On us. There's a couple other events.
Right. Yes, please.
Okay. This has been publicly out there for a while, but Death Row Exonerees are going to be touring North Carolina, speaking at historic gatherings. Together, they spent 196 years on death row. They include a former Air Force sergeant and mail carrier. They include an Ivy League graduate and high school principal and 15 other men. They're all innocent, all exonerated and released from death row. These 18 survivors of death row are coming to North Carolina for one of the largest gatherings of death row exonerees in American history. The exonerees will be the featured speakers at People of Faith Against the Death Penalty's 13th Anniversary Awards Banquet in Raleigh on Saturday, November 3rd at 6 p.m. at St. Raphael, the Archangel Catholic Church, 5801 Falls of Neuse Road. On November 4th, UCC is going to be hosting one of these speakers at our church on that Sunday.
That's United Church of Christ.
United Church of Christ.
And here in Chapel Hill.
In Chapel Hill, yes.
On, what is it?
Martin Luther King Boulevard, our Airport Road, our 86, depending on how long you've been in the area.
Right. And it's right at Homestead Road there.
And it's at Homestead Road, yes.
Yeah. Actually, it's sort of around the corner from where I live. You know, one of the interesting things that in the fiction again of criminal things has been the CSI programs.
Mm, yes,
that now science is going to
prove
whether a person has done the deed or not, and that it's going to be harder and harder not to leave traces of yourself behind. Yeah. You're shedding DIA. I'm shedding DIA as I speak.
Yes. Hair follicles, sweat.
Yes, right. Yes. And so
that's assuming that we were actually that organized in the criminal justice system to actually follow it up as well as they follow it up in the fictional TV show.
And the fictional TV shows.
Yes.
Yes. So obviously, that's the interesting issue, is that we are, our institutions are made of up humans. Of people, and we make mistakes. And the problem with us making mistakes is that most of the roles we're in don't allow us to make mistakes. So, for instance, when I get lost on the show and end up not having it actually broadcast, that's because I'm human and I'm learning, and I find it hard to speak and dial at the same time. So
that's part of what I mean, you go back to religion, you go back to church, you go back to social institutions that are around belief systems, temples or whatever, you know, and I'm like, mosques. And I'm like, you know, there's the human element in it can be alienating, even if the God element in it isn't. And so that's often why I find people like yourself or like myself. My brother-in-law and my sister basically just moved from the small town Clinton all the way to L.A. Mm-hmm. to get away from the church small town community that they had, because his son's mother continued to follow them per church that they went to. And the pastors, being a small town, would embrace them in and alienate them all over again. And so they said, you know what, we're just going to leave. And so, and you often find people leaving, not drastically like that, but leaving, you know. And so I think that this whole thing about criminal justice systems, about church systems, about social systems, we have to keep in mind that there are human beings who do make mistakes. And fortunately for these exonerees, they're human beings who actually are involved in social justice work, who come forth to help people.
Yeah. And so one of the good systems is a system that allows people to admit they're wrong when they are wrong, and find a way of not saving face, but of restoring balance, redressing the issues.
Yes.
It isn't easy, and sometimes it seems hard, but the better systems are that way. One of the things, as a sociologist of religion, you're probably aware of this phenomenon, which is the persistence of systems over time. In other words, it's sort of like, you know, you can go into a prison, you know, with an egalitarian, love thy neighbor mindset.
Yes.
And the system will somehow train you very well to have good walls.
Yeah.
You know,
part of what I'm studying, my dissertation is on interviews with employees and volunteers who are involved in organizations and agencies to help incarcerated men and male ex-offenders. And part of what I'm finding, I mean, in the case of people who get involved in this work, is after a while, you come in thinking you can make change and, oh, my God, I can do this work. And a lot of us are successful at that, but we develop a callousness over time with those that we know we can't help. And it's kind of like we have to focus on the ones that we see actively taking steps themselves to help themselves, and then kind of contribute to their efforts and help them more. But, you know, without their initiative, you know, it becomes impossible.
Yeah, and well, I always found interesting in the a couple of my church families that I noticed that the system was such that no matter who filled the roles in it, they all ended up functioning for the system.
Yes,
even though they themselves may have been there to change the system.
Yes.
And that is a daunting issue.
Yeah, it
you
is.
Know? And not only in family systems, but in but in these, so you have institutions persisting for decades and years in a certain way, some of which causes obviously real human suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way to address suffering is, one, to admit that there is suffering taking
mm-hmm.
place.
Mm-hmm.
I was told, you know, one of the root meanings of suffering is to allow.
Wow.
Remember in the old version,
wow,
suffer little children unto me?
Wow.
I said, what do you mean? Is Jesus a sadist? He wants to suffer these little children unto me? I mean, what's this, you know?
Right.
Is he, you know, is he some kind of, you know, well,
pedophile?
Yeah, exactly. No, actually, suffering means to allow. But it's an allowing that could be troublesome. In other words, it goes beyond what we can control.
Yeah.
Allowing isn't what we control. The allowing of suffering is beyond what we can control. And not necessarily surrendering to it.
Yeah.
But recognizing what it's doing to you.
Yes.
If it's deforming you or hurting someone else.
Yeah.
And to the degree that we're a balanced, holy, happy human being, when someone else is in pain, I, in good conscience, cannot other than feel that pain.
Yes.
If I find that I can have a happiness that doesn't, that could somehow be immune to the suffering of people around me, what is the worth and what is the cost of that happiness?
Yeah, that's why I think you find a lot of people resorting, unfortunately, to substance abuse. You find a lot, 4 to 6, on average, 4 to 6 hours of TV is watched by the average U.S. citizen. You find them going to church, some would say, to not actually deal with the issues or with real human emotions, but to kind of have a face, if you will, that they are, you know, okay, you know, and it's like, and it's about identity, which is why sociology and religion come together for me. And as I interview these employees and volunteers, I ask them, what got you motivated? What were the costs? What were the benefits? What, you know, because a large part, we're all subject to the media institution, which rules us. And media creates fear, not because it's the truth, but because it sells and it sells and it sells. And so how do we as human beings respond to that? And how do, and part of that, I think, is to build community partnerships where we actually talk. Where we actually talk with each other and bond with each other in community and share our stories of pain, just like they did in South Africa, just like they did in Greensboro with the Truth and Reconciliation Committee hearings. They weren't always successful in terms of action, but they got a lot of people to just come forth and share your stories. And that's, I think, of all people, other than psychologists, perhaps, people with faith are really equipped in many ways, those of us who honestly take a look at ourselves, to actually help others honestly look at themselves.
Yeah, actually, from my point of view, one of the aspects of liberation theology that can, you know, make inroads in our secular society is the narrative or story theology.
Yes.
That we are our stories.
Yes.
And that we need to tell our stories. In fact, when I say that Touchstones is a show about religious experience, every one of us, everyone who will come here, has a story. And that story addresses who they are as a human being and who they are in terms of their life choices. But it also addresses something that's profound, that's all of our business. Mm-hmm. There, you know, it has an ultimate concern, to borrow the phrase from Paul Tillich, the
yes.
theologian, is... And this ultimate concern, whether we address it consciously or not as the divine, it can also be our unconscious, but it is there, and it deserves to be honored.
Yes.
And to honor it in a new and dynamic way. Now, I know, isn't there one other group
there,
that you wanted
is.
To talk about?
Let me go ahead and re-say this just in case.
Yes, please do.
If you want more information, just Google it, because that's what I did this morning, but People of Faith Against the Death Penalty. They're having their 13th anniversary awards banquet in Raleigh on Saturday, November 3rd at 6 p.m. in St. Raphael, the Archangel Catholic Church. They need, apparently, volunteers to plan the event, at the event, donations to cover costs, congregations and groups to co-sponsor. You can talk to a guy named Matt Toth, T-O-T-H, at 933-7567, 933-7567. The UCC Church on November 4th at 10 a.m. will have, on Martin Luther King Boulevard in Chapel Hill, we'll have one of these speakers coming to grace us with his presence.
That sounds good. What was the next...
The next thing, yeah. Yes. The next thing is that a lot of us in the area in Orange County, Hillsborough, and in Chapel Hill, from different churches, have been trying to work for the last couple of years, including... your guest, Audrey Williams, from next week, is to put together faith teams who are connected with these men while they're still in prison as community volunteers, and as some of us men get trained to become community volunteers to go inside the prison to help some of these guys come out and go to 12-step meetings or to church. and to get connected in the or to other interfaith institutions, to get connected with people in the community so that you know them as not ex-offender or as prisoner, but you know them as Paul or Demetrius, and you get to bond with these men and you get to actually get to know them. And what happens is over time, a church or another faith institution can bond around these guys and create a team of support for them. And so a number of us have been kind of like, well, how do we get this started? Because there's a woman named Marcia Owens in Durham who's been doing a tremendous amount of work the last 5 years with her different congregations and other faith places in terms of building faith teams and helping men who have been released from Guest Road to get connected. And so we want to kind of like do that here. And we just started last week with our first area faith team partnership meeting, where we had people from the area come together to get information on how are we going to do this.
So what you're looking for then is not only individual volunteers, but perhaps committees of volunteers,
yes,
from different faith-based
organizations
of all stripes,
yes,
to come forward and to welcome.
Or even community-based,
yes,
organizations. If there's like a men's bowling league that just wants to come in. I mean, we need men because we're the ones that can actually go in and take them out. But then we take them to other places where they get to actually start associating and being socialized and what it looks like to be back out again, even for brief amounts of time, so that they can actually know what to do when they come out because they've got a team of support around them.
Yeah, and this is a support of people that they know. And even and when you've been in a total institution,
yes,
even going into a simple thing of going into a store and purchasing,
yes,
something can be very strange and alienating initially.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, you feel like you're on another planet.
Yeah, I've got freedom. I mean, I don't have to get up or move at a certain time with a certain pace, you know.
Yeah.
I actually can do, and then, well, what do I do with that freedom? Do I go back to the old social networks that helped me get into trouble in the first place? Or can we develop new social networks around these guys to give them other options?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of my life has been, if I hadn't had a mentor encourage me to go to divinity school, I wouldn't have been able to be supportive. In terms of my own walk, in terms of getting in recovery and staying sober. So I've had people along the way who have supported me in terms of the things that I need to do. And this is just an opportunity to support someone else. Now, on November 15th, once a month, we're going to come together as the Orange County Faith Team Partners. And we're going to, so November 15th, we have this woman from Marcia Owens from Durham coming to meet with us. And we meet at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church in Hillsboro. And
right,
if you want contact information, you can call me. My name is Demetrius, and it's 619-0912. And this is just the local Orange County campaigns that are sustaining, hopefully, over time and building together with each other faith teams to help support these men as they are still currently in prison, but as they also come out and rejoin us in community to give them better options.
That sounds good. By the way, St. Matthew's is a beautiful little church, if you've never visited it, in our colonial town of Hillsboro, which is definitely of interest. So, you know, we have initiatives, and obviously we can't keep incarcerating more and more people.
We have 650,000 incarcerated in federal and state prisons right now, 1,600 being released every day. If we don't help them have better options, we're going to all be impacted because of families and support networks and just community at large with public safety and crime issues. We need to do something.
Yeah.
And faith or no faith.
Yeah. Yeah, we need to find ways of dealing with one another that is non-dehumanizing and non-violent, one that makes a place for people and gives them a place at the table, allows them to assume some dignity, the right to have a job and to earn a reasonable living and to belong to someone, the rights to have genuine human relationships. It sounds like, oh yes, those things are in my life, you know, perhaps, but to some degree. But we have a system which makes it very, very difficult for people who are get out of step with it to embrace these very important things. And of course, the bigger question is why is it we do this?
Well, part of that is some of the things, my preliminary data for my work research. One of the guys said, we come with this idea that we're coming to help save, or we're coming to help. We're coming to give something that we offer as people of faith, or as just people, And he's like, but I feel like we're graced by these people. I received this person's company, and they've got so much information and so much of their lives that I get to hear and connect with. And I think ultimately the connections that we can make by just being open and listening. Even if you don't want to get involved, you can show up at some of these events just as a fan, and help encourage the rest of us who are in the choir to keep going. It's like you get this thing that I think is part of the reason why people seek religion in the first place, which is how can I be connected with that I feel like I'm aware of that's outside of what I can see and feel and touch.
Yeah, let's talk about the other end of the crime issue, which are victims. And there's been a lot of noise about victims' rights, and I think important because...
Oh, yeah.
If you've ever been mugged, or if you've had your house burglarized, you probably realized that you felt violated in ways that reverberated more deeply than anybody else wanted to hear about.
Definitely. And then where can you come and tell that story, being victims, which is another piece of the community storytelling that I think needs to happen.
Yeah.
I will point out that because of our large degree of segregation, that you're often more at risk within your home from a family member or someone you know who has access to you than you do someone who does not necessarily look like you or is connected to you. And so, in other words, a large part of those victims are among blacks themselves within their poor communities, or among the poor within the poor community, because those are the people who are under stress. And whether you go to Liverpool, England, I have one of my students, I teach as well at college level at Elon currently, and one of the things that I have them do is read the story. It talks about how bad the poverty conditions are and how bad lack of jobs and homes and things like that. And they're like, and I'm like, so where does this take place? And then I break out that it's Liverpool, England. Wherever you have a large pocket of poor people, you're going to have this effect of people being desperate enough to commit crimes on a more, on a more than average level.
Yeah.
And those people usually victimize themselves. And so domestic violence, the Super Bowl is the largest time of the year for domestic violence, sadly to say, and it's within the family and the homes. And so people's perceptions are way distorted because of the media. And I was really happy to hear you point that out.
Yeah, I would like to deal a little more with this distortion of violence is in my own life. When we're younger, I think we have depending on a variety of things, have a little more tolerance for violence as we learn things. And as I've gotten older, I've decided that one of my forms of violence is shouting. In other words, I know when I'm excited or angry or upset, my voice, I'm going to raise the timbre. I'm going to begin to get loud. You're going to get really loud and get emphatic, in fact.
Yes.
And I realize that this is a form of intimidation.
Yes.
And, sometimes I'm still pissed off. I'm still raising my voice. I'll say to the person, as this is myself, this is a try to self-monitoring here in my old age.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I know I'm excited about this, and I know I'm feeling, angry, or I'm feeling righteous, or whatever it is. I'm feeling passionate about this issue right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I'm shouting, I'm not trying to intimidate you. I'm not trying to I'm not trying to beat you up. I'm not trying to force you to accept my point of view.
Yes.
I think what I'm trying to do is telling you that whatever my point of view is, it seems damn important to me right now.
Yes.
I got my passions up. So for me, this is good. This is good because, years before, some decades back, I'd be more likely to gesticulate, and it would seem even more intimidating when I'm throwing my arms and legs around, and looking like I could be violent. So violence is learned.
Yeah.
And most people don't think shouting is necessarily a form of violence. In fact, most Italians would probably think that it's just the way you make a point, you know. So it does vary a great deal in terms of our societies. But if we can realize that we have these monitors within ourselves, we have these feelings, and then to find which ways work best for us.
I got sober because I committed an act of domestic violence. Having been trained as the oldest of four to take care of children and to respect the women who had raised me,
right.
I just woke up and said, wow, I can't believe I did that, and I can't be that guy. That's when my sobriety started in the last great 14 years of my life started. And it was because I could not deal with the fact that my learned treatment of violence was to stuff things inside. And then when I got to a place where they were so stuffed, I exploded. I couldn't deal with who that person was. And so most people who know me are like, wow, you did what? You know, because that's certainly not who I am now. But that's the process of being given a second chance. It's a process of growth. It's a process of, hey, becoming aware that, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore. And most of the guys I work with are exactly like me. Like, this is something I did, you know, years ago, or... yeah, I had that substance abuse thing. I found the 12-step programs in prison that I'm now a member of or whatever. And they actually try to give back and to change things, even within prison, let alone as they come out of prison. And so for me, I felt like I was in prison within myself. And there's a lot of us in the society who are more locked up than the men I encounter inside prison. And to be made more aware and to come forward and to have support around you to express yourself more, I think is part of what God's work is in this world.
And though I did say something that one of the reasons that people belong to churches is for reasons of maintaining safe inauthenticity, I also need to say and counter to that one of the places where you can go to change yourself, incubations of better behavior, of learning how to monitor your things, can happen in churches. And in membership of small groups,
even if it's
a bowling league.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, with bowling league, you'll learn maybe not to punch your bowling mates when you don't have the strike quite right. But that may not translate into your relationship with your wife or kids.
Yeah.
So context is everything here, and. That's one of the things that, you know, churches serve. Churches do serve families. They do serve people who are living in relationship.
Definitely.
Husbands, wives, or life partners, since many churches now, particularly the United Church of Christ, is open to gay and lesbian membership. And I would hope that eventually more and more churches would see that it isn't who you sleep with, it's that you have an authentic and loving relationship with another human being.
Definitely.
No matter what its relative constraints seems to be.
One of my main concerns, actually, at this point is the military and the public services that have been cut to address their needs. We've historically proven that as people come back from the military, they need domestic violence counseling, they need domestic partnership counseling, they need counseling, PTSD counseling, and these are things that have been cut from the men that we and women that we have sent and that have been engaged in these things. So when they come back, you want to talk about violence coming back into a community, across the board, we need to create efforts to help everyone that are in social institutions or total institutions to address the life outside of them.
Yeah, not only this, but the children that are in these relationships are going to become another victim.
Yes.
Apparently, we seem to have a cycle of war in our society, which is about every 20 years we support this war. It's sort of the father-son initiative of war. And the thing is that the dehumanization that takes place on the part of men who are in war is such that we don't address it as a community, and it would be better if we could address it.
I call the guys that I work with, I kind of see them as having a triple burden often, and if you're a woman, I guess it would be quadruple. But the fact of the matter is, most of these people are poor without services, and they started off as children without services, and then a lot of them are men of color. And then they come out and they get the stigma of, ooh, you know, before we'd be like, oh, they were on vacation or they served their time and they were brought back into the community. Now we're like, oh, my gosh, they're the pariah of our society and we can't even talk to them. Another friend of mine that I interviewed pointed out to me, he said that you could be living right next to one and not even know. And I was like, wow. Now, if that got out publicly, I think we'd have a lot more fear. But the fact of the matter is they could be the best of people if you gave them a chance.
That's one of the challenges that we have is that one of the ways that we redeem ourselves is to act and stand for the redemption of others.
Yes.
In fact, the very fact of redemption comes from God ransoming the people of Israel out of slavery in Egypt.
Yes, exactly why I went to Divinity School, to study that and the slavery that happened here within our own country, and how did people come out of that, or how are people still being affected by that, trying to come out of that, given that there were no reparations.
And as one well-known political scientist said, he says, wherever you are, know you are living in Egypt.
Yes.
And know that you are a Jew living in Egypt.
Yes.
No matter who you are,
yes,
we are living in Egypt.
Or somebody else said, stranger in a strange land.
Yes. So, folks, I really hope that you have enjoyed this initial time. Demetrius, you are a godsend. I am so happy that I stumbled across you last Sunday.
Let me put out my number one more time.
Yeah.
For any of the things that I've talked about today, I'm available to anyone at any time at 619-0912.
And anyone out there who's listening to this show who has a religious or experience or story that they want to tell.
Or
a spiritual experience. Feel free to contact me. You can contact me at PNAGY@wordtrade.com. That's WORDTRADE.com. Also, if you know of anyone who is interested or has an interesting story to tell that's a religious or spiritual experience, this is the place where we can share it to our larger community of Carrboro and Chapel Hill. I hope to have many people, not only of the mainstream Christian traditions, but also of the evangelical traditions, which I'm sure will be fun, as they try to get me to convert, and I try to tell them about universal Christ. And
yes,
and I
dialogue.
Think, yes, the dialogue will be fun. And it may not always be easy, and it may not always be smooth, but we will do our best to present a variety of religious points of view on this show. In fact, all possibility. Jewish, Christian, Muslim.
Humanistic,
Buddhist, Hindu.
Wiccan.
Yes, actually, I am a practicing Wiccan myself.
Well, there you go.
You know, though, we'll tell our stories in due time, and we will deal with a variety of things. We'll also deal with alternative metaphysical groups.
Cool.
We'll deal with some of the historic groups such as spiritualists and other groups like that. And we'll have basically people be coming in here telling their own story in their own words, and with my sort of hopefully not too rude editorial aside.
William James would be proud.
Yes. So on that note, I think that we're going to be winding up in a few minutes, and I think we'll do a play out of some music. So thank you for tuning in. I will be back here next Tuesday at 11 until noon on WCOM, Carrboro Chapel Hill.
103.5.
I got to see that sign. I've got to see that sign somewhere. Right,
thank you there for having me, Paul.
Yeah. Thank you, Demetrius.
We're still working on things.
Yeah, we're working on stuff here.
Yeah.
We'll get this going.
Very supportive community here in Orange County.
Yeah. Well, this is our musical interlude. It will be coming up here in a second, I hope.
It's been an honor to work in this community. It's very supportive, the openness in Chapel Hill and Carrboro.
It's hard to believe we're in the South, huh?
Very true. Although they did try to publicly put a gate around it, I think it was suggested years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yes, actually, and I think it was Jesse Helms that used to call people that lived up here Commie Hill, but that was a while back.
CD2.
So.
The button on.
I hope to see those of you who have been listening out at some of these events.
Yeah, and if you see Demetrius, tell him that you heard about it from WCOM. Carrboro. So this is it. Take care.
Goodbye.
Bye.